And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it's October 29th. 302nd day of the year. 63 days remain till the year is over with. You know, I've read some interesting things on the net. Some of the sites that like to put up crazy stories are complaining that no matter how crazy their stories, this administration comes up with something crazier. They can't come up with anything that's just so completely absurd because the Biden administration will beat it. And some of the things they are coming up with make no rational sense, I gotta say. Well, on this day in 312, Constantine the Great enters Rome after his victory at the Battle of Milvian Bridge. Stages a grand adventus in the city and is met with popular jubilation. Maxentius's body's fished out of the Tiber and formally beheaded. That's adding insult to injury. 437, Valentinian III, the Western Roman Emperor. Remember, the Roman Empire became so big it was divided into two. The Western, based out of Rome, and the Eastern, which became known as the Byzantine Empire, based out of Constantinople. But in 437, Valentinian III married Lucinia Eudoxia, daughter of his cousin Theodosius II, the Eastern Roman Emperor in Constantinople. That unified the two branches of the House of Theodosius. In 1268, Conradin is executed along with his companion, Frederick I, Margrave of Baden, by Charles I of Sicily. 1390, first trial for witchcraft in Paris, leading to the death of three people. You know, the very idea that people could be executed for the belief that they control the black arts is about as crazy as some of the things that we see going on today. 1467, Battle of Brustum. Charles the Bold defeats Prince Bisferick of Liege. 1591, Pope Innocent IX is elected. 1611, Russian homage to the King of Poland, Sigismund III Vasa. 1618, English adventurer, writer, and courtier Sir Walter Raleigh is beheaded for allegedly conspiring against James I of England. 1621, the London pageant of 1621 celebrates the inauguration of Edward Barkham as Lord Mayor of London. 1658, Second Northern War, naval forces of the Dutch Republic defeat the Swedes in the Battle of the Sound. 1665, Portuguese forces defeat the Kingdom of Congo, decapitate King Antonio I of Congo. He's also known as Navita Anakanga. 1675, Leibniz makes the first use of the long S as a symbol of the integral in calculus. 1787, Mozart's opera Don Giovanni gets its first performance in Prague. 1792, Mount Hood in Oregon is named after Samuel Hood, first Viscount Hood, by Lieutenant William Broughton, who sighted the mount near the mouth of the Willamette River. 1863, now I notice in the rush of the woke folk to change all the names, nobody's wanted to change the name of Mount Hood. 1863, 18 countries meet Geneva and agree to form the International Red Cross. Also that same year, in the American Civil War, Battle of Wauhatchie, forces under Union General Ulysses S. Grant repel a Confederate attack led by General James Longstreet. This allows Union forces to open a supply line into Chattanooga, Tennessee. 1888, the Convention of Constantinople signed. guarantees free maritime passage through the Suez Canal during war and peace. 1901, in Amherst, Massachusetts, nurse Jane Toppin is arrested for murdering the Davis family of Boston with an overdose of morphine. 1901, Leon Kossoff, the assassin of President McKinley, is executed by electrocution. 1914, Ottoman entry into World War I. They sided with the Germans, don't you know? 1918, the German high seas fleet is incapacitated when sailors mutiny. This action would trigger the German Revolution of 1918. 19, the German Revolution was a civil conflict in the German Empire at the end of the First World War. Resulted in the replacement of the German federal constitutional monarchy with a democratic parliamentary republic that later became known as the Weimar Republic. The revolutionary period, if you want to call it that, lasted from November 1918 to the adoption of the Weimar Constitution in August of 1919. Among the factors that led to the revolution were the extreme burdens suffered by the German people during the 4 years of war, the economic and psychological impacts of the German Empire's defeat by the Allies, and the growing social tensions between the general population and the aristocratic and bourgeois elite. Basically, they didn't like losing. And that was the basis of Hitler's rise to power. They had been betrayed from inside. 1921, U.S. Second trial of Sacco and Vanzetti in Boston. Now, Sacco and Vanzetti were Italian immigrant anarchists who were controversially accused of murdering a guard and a paymaster during an April 15, 1920 armed robbery of the Slatter and Morrell Shoe Company in Braintree, Massachusetts. 7 years after that, they were electrocuted in the electric chair at Charlestown State Prison. Took the jury only a few hours' deliberation to convict the two of first-degree murder, and they were sentenced to death by the trial judge. Now, anti-Italianism, anti-immigrant, anti-anarchist bias were suspected of having influenced the jury. There were a number of appeals funded by the private Sacco and Vanzetti Defense Committee. These appeals were based on recanted testimony, conflicted ballistic evidence, a prejudicial pre-trial statement by the jury foreman, and a confession by an alleged participant in the robbery. The trial judge, Webster Thayer, denied all the appeals. And they were also later denied by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. Well, the investigations in the aftermath of the executions continued through the 1940s. The publication of the men's letters contained eloquent professions of innocence, intensified a belief that they were wrongfully executed, and later analysis also added doubt to their guilt in the crimes to which they were convicted. Now, Sacco was a shoemaker and a night watchman. He was born in 1891 in Torremaggiore, province of Foggia, now Apulia. Migrated to the U.S. at the age of 17. Worked in his father's vineyard before immigrating, often sleeping out in the field at night to prevent animals from destroying the crop. Vanzetti was a fishmonger, born in 1888 in Villa Veleto, province of Quena in Piedmont region. Both left Italy for the U.S. in 1908. They didn't meet until 1917. Well, you know, the question of whether or not they were guilty really got lost and the political ramifications of the whole thing. 1921, Harvard University football team loses to Center College ending a 25-game winning streak. This was considered one of the biggest upheavals in college football at the time. 1923, Turkey becomes a republic following the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire. At the end of World War I, the Ottoman Empire was pretty much on its last legs. 1929, New York Stock Exchange crashes in what's called the Crash of 29, or Black Tuesday. Ends the great bull market of the 20s and begins the Great Depression. 1941, Holocaust. In the Kaunas Ghetto, over 10,000 Jews are shot by German occupiers at the Ninth Fort, a massacre known as the Great Action. 1942, Holocaust. In the UK, leading clergymen and political figures hold a public meeting to register outrage over Nazi Germany's persecution of Jews. 1944, the Dutch city of Breda is liberated by the 1st Polish Armored Division. Also in 44, World War II, the Soviet Red Army enters Hungary. 1948, Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Safsaf massacre. Israeli soldiers captured a Palestinian village of Safsaf in the Galilee district. Afterwards, between 52 and 64 villagers are massacred by the Israeli Defense Force. 1953, BCPA Flight 304, it's a DC-6, crashes near San Francisco. 1955, the Soviet battleship Novorossiysk strikes a World War II mine at the harbor of Sevastopol. 1956, Suez Crisis begins. Israeli forces invade the Sinai Peninsula and push Egyptian forces back toward the Suez Canal. 1957, Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion and five of his ministers are injured when Moshe Dweck throws a grenade into the Knesset. 1960, an airplane carrying the Cal Poly football team crashes on takeoff in Toledo, Ohio. 1964, the United Republic of Tanganyika and Zanzibar is renamed to the United Republic of Tanzania. 1967, Montreal's World Fair, Expo 67, closes with over 50 million visitors. 1969, the first ever computer-to-computer link is established on ARPANET, the precursor to the Internet. 1972, three surviving perpetrators of the Munich massacre released from prison in exchange for the hostages of the hijacked Lufthansa Flight 615. Now, for those that don't remember, the Munich massacre was an attack during the 1972 Summer Olympics in Munich. It was done by eight members of the Palestinian terrorist group Black September. They took nine members of the Israeli Olympic team hostage, killed two more. They called the operation Igrit and Baram after two Palestinian Christian villages whose inhabitants were expelled by the Israeli Defense Force during the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. Black September commander was Lutif Afif, who was also the negotiator. West German neo-Nazis gave the group logistical assistance. Short after the hostages were taken, a fifth demanded the release of 234 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and the West German held founders of the Red Army faction, Andreas Bader and Ulrike Meinhof. Five of the eight Black September members were killed during a failed attempt to rescue the hostages, all of whom were killed. West German policeman was also killed in the crossfire. Three surviving perpetrators were Adrian Al-Ghashi, Jamal Al-Ghashi, and Mohammed Safadi. They were arrested next month. Following the hijack of Lufthansa Flight 615, the West German government released them in a hostage exchange. Israeli government launched Operation Wrath of God, which authorized the Mossad to track down and kill those involved in the massacre. Yeah. A lot of lunatics in this world. In 1980, demonstration flight of a secretly modified C-130 for an Iran hostage crisis rescue attempt ends in a crash landing at Eglin Air Force Base's Duke Field in Florida. Leads to the cancellation of Operation Credible Sport. Where do they get these names? 1985, Major General Samuel Doe's announced as the winner of the first multi-party election in Liberia. 1986, British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher opens the last stretch of the M25 motorway. 1991, the American Galileo spacecraft makes its closest approach to 951 Gaspra, becomes the first probe to visit an asteroid. 1994, Francisco Martin Duran fires over 24 shots at the White House, later convicted of trying to kill President Bill Clinton. 1998, South Africa, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, presents its report to condemns both sides for committing atrocities. 1998, Space Shuttle Discovery blast off on STS-95 with 77-year-old John Glenn on board. Up to that point in time, he was the oldest person to go into space. Now William Shatner is Captain Kirk. 1998, ATSC HDTV broadcasting in the U.S. is inaugurated with the launch of STS-95 space shuttle mission. Also in 98, while en route from Adana to Ankara, a Turkish Airlines flight with a crew of 6 and 33 passengers is hijacked by a Kurdish militant who orders the pilot to fly to Switzerland. Plane instead lands in Ankara. After the pilot tricked the hijacker into thinking he's landing in the Bulgarian capital of Sofia to refuel. Can't get hijackers like he used to. 1998, Hurricane Mitch, the second deadliest Atlantic hurricane in history, makes landfall in Honduras. Also in 1998, the Gothenburg discotheque fire in Swedish Hills kills 63 and injures 200. 1999, a large cyclone devastates Odisha, India. 2002, a fire destroys a luxurious department store in Ho Chi Minh City where 1,500 people are shopping. More than 60 die and over 100 are unaccounted for in what's considered the deadliest peacetime disaster in Vietnam. They have no information on how it started. 2004, the Arabic language news network Al Jazeera broadcast an excerpt from a 2004 Osama bin Laden video in which the terrorist leader admits direct responsibility for the September 11, 2001 attack and references the 2004 U.S. presidential election. 2005, bombings in Delhi, India kill more than 60. 2008, Delta Airlines merges with Northwest Airlines, creating the world's largest... largest airline and reducing the number of U.S. legacy carriers to 5. 2012, Hurricane Sandy hits the east coast of the U.S., kills 148 directly and 138 indirectly, leaves nearly $70 billion in damages and causes major power outages. 2015, China announces the end of its one-child policy. After 35 years, until that point in time, couples were allowed one child. 2018, a Boeing 737 MAX plane crashes after taking off from Jakarta, Indonesia, kills all 198 on board. And in 2020, Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the Labour Party and of the opposition in the UK, suspended from the Labour Party following his response to findings from the EHRC on the issue of anti-Semitism within the party. All right. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays observances: Christian Feast Day, Abraham of Rostov, Blessed Chiara Badano, Coleman McDog, Doi Martyrs, Gaetano Errico, James Hannington in the Anglican Church, Narcissus of Jerusalem in the Roman Catholic Church, in Cambodia it's Coronation Day, and in Turkey it is Republic Day. Well, see if there's anything else of interest. In 539 BC, King Cyrus, the Great of Persia, marches into Babylon, frees Jewish captives, allows them to return home. In 1268, Conradin, the last legitimate male heir of the German Hohenstaufen dynasty of kings and Holy Roman emperors, is executed by Frederick I, Margrave of Baden, is executed with Frederick I, Margrave of Baden, by Charles I of Sicily. In 1956, on this date, Chet Huntley and David Brinkley team up to launch the Huntley-Brinkley Report. I remember growing up watching that. 1960, this was Cassius Clay's, or Muhammad Ali's, first professional fight. 1961, this is also Joseph Goebbels' birthday. Richard Dreyfuss' birthday. Kate Jackson's birthday. All right. I think that pretty much wraps that up. You know, today is, as I said, the 29th of October. Halloween is in 2 days. For over 20 years, I did a ghost tour in El Paso every Saturday night. I still have the company, but folks have hijacked the name and they're doing their own thing. However, in order to appreciate the true uniqueness of El Paso, you have to know some of the history. El Paso is the most haunted city in the country. And in addition to haunted locations, and I've written a number of books. In fact, I'm doing a ghost tour tonight at Fort Bliss. Fort Bliss has requested it. It may come as a surprise to many people, but there have been a lot of stories about lost Spanish gold mines, buried treasure, and other riches being hidden in the caves located in the recesses of the Franklin Mountains. Now, I've had one self-styled expert in El Paso history assure me there are no caves in the Franklin Mountains. But keep in mind that scientists also said rocks don't fall from the sky because there are no rocks in the sky. Don't know what they call meteors. You know, across the West, there have been a lot of stories about the so-called Lost Padre Mine. And I've been an amateur treasure hunter since I was old enough to walk. When I lived in California, I used to do $200 or $300 a weekend wandering around the beaches with a metal detector. And I read a lot of stories in treasure hunting literature about the Lost Padre Mine being found in the mountains outside of Los Angeles or maybe San Diego or possibly Phoenix. And let's don't forget the Oregon Mountains in New Mexico. And each of these areas had what was called the Lost Padre Mine that was worked by the Spanish. Now, in each instance, the individual who searched in that particular location is certain he's on the trail of the one and only Lost Padre Mine. And in the many treasure stories, the lucky finder of the lost Padre mine will become wealthy beyond the dreams of Midas. Well, El Paso has its own lost Padre mine. And there was a lady who had an antique store. My wife and I used to go by there and we'd buy one item just to make sure she had some income. Very nice lady. And she had a brother who used to wander the hills. And he was one of many people that I knew of who turned that into an income-making venture. He was always finding odd things. Well, he started having a lot of money. And nobody really knew how, because he wasn't working. Well, one day, he handed her a dictionary, and he said, "This is the secret to my wealth." And since she was retiring the last time we saw her, she gave me that dictionary, and she said, "There is a code hidden in this dictionary that tells where my brother found his wealth." Now, there was, in the hills above El Paso, there is a lost mine. And I've got a story that printed in the local paper from 1892 that makes reference to it. And according to this story, tourists who stop in El Paso on the way to the city of Mexico or California always visit the ancient church at Juarez. There are electric cars that cross the Rio Grande after a 30-second stop for the customs officer. One of the places it goes is the ancient church. Now, the old church on the square at Juarez is in every guidebook. It's a visitor's first introduction to ancient Mexico. And a lot has been written about it. And people from Maine to Oregon drop their nickels into the slot for the repair of the church. But those at the Padre took a liking to, heard what was called the story of the lost mine. Now, every locality where precious metal has been found has got a story about a lost mine, and El Paso County is no exception. And the tradition links this ancient mine to the ancient church. Now, at the corner of the church, to the left of the main entrance is a tower, the door of which is usually kept padlocked. Now, visitors are free to enter the church and look at the unusually jointed wooden ceiling, the pulpit with its eccentric stair on one side, the confessional, which is wholly unlike those seen at the Catholic churches in the U.S., and the Madonna-like face of Our Lady of Guadalupe. Even the great wooden cross on which is hung a ghastly form for the crucifixion procession once a year is exhibited. But that tower, oh, that tower is locked up tight. Those who aren't permitted by special favor to pass that locked door find a stairway of logs, the end of which overlap and form the axis of the circling steps. And that's the only support those steps have. At the top of this unusual architectural feature, there's a small room that looks out through the heavy walls. But from that small room leads the way to the lost mine. Now, the church itself is on an elevation, and the tower gives a view over the flat tops of the one-story houses. And in the distance, you can see the Franklin Mountains. And, if conditions are right, you can see the entrance to the Lost Mine. You have to stand in a certain position and look through a certain window, and in a line with certain natural landmarks. And you'll see the exact location of that Lost Mine. Now the question is, what's the place to stand? Which is the window in question? And what are the landmarks you're supposed to look for? Even the Padre doesn't know. Now, by tradition, this mine was worked before the Spanish conquest. It was very rich, and from it, the natives along the Rio Grande got the massive gold ornaments that they wore when the Spaniards arrived. And in the early history of the church, many of these golden ornaments eventually wound up on the altar of the church. But there was a long war, and incursions of Apaches and Comanches made the mountains unhealthy for non-natives. And the Pueblo Rebellion brought the attention of everybody. Then there was the American invasion. Amid exciting scenes, the natives lost track of the mine. Your descendants have the tradition. They know about the church tower and the window. But the problem is, in the building of the mission, that view was blocked. Now, it was said in the evening you could see the campfires of the workers who camped outside the mine. And then with the Pueblo Rebellion, when everybody's sure that the fighting was going to get here, the mine was closed. Except for one monk who stayed there. Now, that story I just related, which was in the newspaper, September 3rd, 1892, goes into a lot of detail. The story is written by a man by the name of Stevens. Walter Stevens, to be exact. But he doesn't state where he got his information. Now, that old church that he talked about was built over 400 years ago during the time of the Spanish conquest. And if you question whether there's gold to be found in this area, there is one neighborhood in El Paso where homeowners can actually mine gold in their backyards after a heavy rain. It's the subdivision of Richmar, and there was quite a lot written about it in the Herald Post, which was a second newspaper that used to publish in El Paso. Now, the Pueblo Revolt of 1680 gave birth to one of El Paso's most persistent legends, and that's the one of the Lost Padre Mine, as I mentioned. It's been handed down from generation to generation. But, of course, supposedly, prior to 1680, the Spanish Padres worked an exceptionally rich deposit of gold on Mount Franklin. And the mine was located so that at night the fires of the miners could be seen from the bell tower of the mission. That's the tower where, if you stand in the right place and look through the right window at the right landmarks, you see the entrance to the mine. But when word filtered south of the Paso del Norte, as this area was called, that the Indians had revolted and were killing Spaniards or driving them from the province, the good fathers decided their energies and those of the miners could be better put to use in defending the settlement. So for safekeeping, they hid the mine. They're supposed to have taken their gold bullion, smelted from the ore taken from the mine, waiting shipment to Mexico City, and all the precious vessels and other objects from the church, and they put it in the mine shaft,
filling it with the reddish earth from the river bottom, and then they hid the entrance so cunningly that no trace of it could be found. Then in the general confusion of the Pulborough Revolt, and the location became lost forever. Now another version says that the Indians massacred the miners, concealed the shaft, and carved a face on the ridge of the mountain, said to be that of Chetwa, the chief guarding the mine forever. Now, even in spite of the centuries that have passed, many, the tourist, prospector, promoter, and adventurer who's walked up the narrow, hand-hewn steps of the ancient mission and tried to find the entrance to the mine on Mount Franklin. Now, it's said that in the Canyon of the Red Doors, there's a fabulously rich gold mine that had been worked by the Franciscan Fathers. This ancient church legend, an old Guadalupean Juarez says. Now, the canyon entrance, which is faced with red sandstone, is supposed to be visible to the north from the church. As I said, lights from the workers' campfires could be seen at night around the mine entrance. Now, the old Spanish records said the mine at Paso del Norte was the richest of all the Spanish workings in the New World, and that says something. More than 300 years has passed since the legend originated, but the mine has only been found, to my knowledge, twice since that time. Now, Indian uprisings against Spanish rule and religion drove the Franciscans back into central Mexico about 1680. But before they left, they're said to have hidden chalices and gold plate and church relics and altar cloths and other valuables from old Guadalupe. It was put in the mine for safety. Then a huge slab of rock marked with a rude cross was placed over the entrance, and all traces of the mining operation were obliterated. Now, two El Pasoans, Don Thompson and Jack Ronan, came upon that legend in 1924, and they gathered all available historical information and instituted a careful search of the Franklin and Oregon Mountains by airplane. Within a few miles of El Paso, they did find a place that exactly qualified as the site. A big rock slide had covered half the canyon, filling it full of shale and boulders at the head. Well, going on foot to the canyon, they found an old Mexican working at the top of the slide with pick and crowbar. Now, they questioned him, but of course, he didn't give them very specific answers. Ronan, who spoke fluent Spanish, finally asked the old man if he was searching for the lost mine of the Franciscans. And after a few minutes, he admitted that's what he was doing. He said he'd found the cross-marked slab that had been moved by the rock slide from its location over the mine's entrance. Then he wandered off down the mountain, and they didn't see him again. So Thompson and Ronan staked out mining claims and began excavating. They found a crudely forged octagonal chisel of great antiquity. It was found in a cave in the canyon wall after removal of part of the slide. And it was of the type of design favored by the Spaniards centuries ago. Well, unfortunately for them, the rock slide made it difficult for them to achieve anything. But even centuries of confusion don't seem to stop treasure hunters. And even today, Prospectors are still looking for the Lost Padre mine. Now, what keeps this treasure story from being assigned to the realm of myth? Are the many stories who claim that they've actually found the elusive treasure? But for one reason or another, they haven't been able to claim it. I found an old magazine called Frontier Times. And they printed a lot of stories from the past. And this one particular story was written by a young lady named Jessie Peterson, who said she was the sister of one of two young men who actually found the mine entrance. Her brother was named Horace, and a friend of his named Henry once found the hiding place of the treasure of the Nuestra Señora de Guadalupe mission at Juarez, Mexico. Now, she said her brother died shortly after his discovery of the treasure, and his friend also died shortly after his one descent into the mine. Now, that supports the superstition that there's a curse that was placed on the mine. But she said, though both had died, her brother died of a disease and his friend was a victim of World War I. Now, legend tells of a warning of an attack by Apaches on the Church of Guadalupe. Now, I will say, at the time the little community of Franklin grew up, this area was overrun with Comanches, and they were so fierce even the Apaches were afraid of them. Now, at the time of the warning of this attack, the priest had their friend, the Indian converts, load the mission's treasures on the back of burros and take it across the Rio Grande to an old cave on the southwestern slope of El Paso's Mount Franklin. And this treasure supposedly consisted of pure silver and gold. I don't know where everybody picks when I'm doing my show to try to call. Well, there was also a lot of other wealth that belonged to the various citizens in Juarez who gave it to the mission for safekeeping. Now, this particular cave was chosen because it could be seen at certain hours of the day from the belfry of the mission. And the priest could tell if it had been bothered by their enemies. And the priest who kept a daily record of church affairs is supposed to have drawn a map, which over the centuries has disappeared. Now, when the little settlement was attacked soon after by a large band of Apaches, the priest and most of the defending Indians were killed. And those who survived were afraid to speak about the mission's treasure, even to their own people, because they thought there was a curse attached to it. They feared their enemies would capture and torture them for the information about the location of the wealth. Only years later did these survivors make mention to their relatives about the lost treasure. Well, when new priests came to take over the work started by their massacred brothers, they were made aware of the wealth on Mount Franklin. But the map that had been drawn was never found, although there was a search made to try to find it. Well, about 50 years before this article was written, the author's brother and his friend decided they were going to find that treasure. And they were very systematic in their approach. They haunted the belfry of the old mission, and from dawn to dusk, they kept their field glasses trained on Mount Franklin. And finally, they spotted what they thought was the entrance to a cave. They made an outline map, and one day the two went out on an actual physical search. They had an old Ford car, and they drove it to the western slope of the mountain and set about climbing the steep sides. Carrying only a sack lunch and two canteens of water, they climbed slowly because Horace had tuberculosis. And he didn't have a lot of strength, but they
dedicated to finding it together. And although they started from home at an early hour, the sun was already low in the west when they found the cave entrance. And it wasn't a cave at all, but the mouth of an old abandoned mine shaft. They found a ladder made of timber that had rotted away, leaving only a round rung here and a rung there. Henry, who was a strapping young man, volunteered to go down in the cave, but rather than use the ladder, they dropped a rope. And they decided to keep the finding of the cave a secret from their families so they could return the next day and see what they had found. Now, both were so excited over the good luck that Horace wasn't able to sleep that night. And when his wife, whose name was Mary Ann, commented on his nervousness, he said he was just tired. And she wasn't exactly thrilled when he and his friend went out again the next day. Well, they left at sunrise, and since they were familiar with where they were going, they made much better time getting there. Henry said later he may had to make Horace sit down every so often to take a breather. Now, Henry Hammond, who was the big husky friend, brought a good strong rope, 60 feet of it. And they put some big rocks at the entrance around which they put the rope. And Henry descended. He had a flashlight and a pistol on his hip. He had told his friend, "I don't know why I'm taking a pistol. I'm not expecting any opposition from anything down there, but you never know." Well, Horace sat as Henry lowered himself in, and Henry said as he descended into the blackness of the mine, his eyes were trying to pierce the gloom. And in after a few minutes, Horace said he began to hear gunshots. He didn't know what was going on. But after a few minutes, Henry climbed back out of the hole. And as he sat, he wiped the sweat off his face and said, "Damned if that cave isn't full of rattlesnakes. Never saw so many. Must be 100. Well, the sandy bottom of the shaft, he said it looked like water moving. There was so much movement. And the snakes had made a bed there. And against the back wall, there were sacks and chests and olas, which are the big water jars. Now the question is, how to get around the snakes? Well, today, it'd be easy to deal with them, but this was before World War I. And the two decided to keep what they'd found secret until they could figure out how to get to it. They might not have been able to figure out a way to get around the snakes, but they weren't going to risk having somebody else steal the treasure. Well, shortly after that, Henry got drafted into World War I and never came back. Horace became weaker and weaker with tuberculosis, and one day he called his sister over and he told her he was really feeling the effects of the disease, and they had been notified that Henry was dead. And he told his sister what they'd found. He said, "I'm going to draw you a map." So if something does happen to If the story about Henry dying is true and I don't survive, I want you to be able to find the treasure. And you divide it three ways. One share for yourself, one to Henry's mother, and one for his wife. You don't have to find a way to get around the snakes, but... Now, Horace was only 34 at this point in time. But a few days later, he died of tuberculosis. And though his sister searched every place they thought he might have gotten to hide the map, they never found it. They thought maybe he had changed his mind about creating the map. Well, you know, several years after this incident took place, the cathedral was built in Juarez, which blocked the view from the bell tower of the old mission. But there is a lot of evidence that, in fact, there is a mine. In fact, there are quite a number of lost treasures said to be hidden in the Franklins. You know, there's also a lot of stories of ghosts and hauntings, as I've discussed. The most haunted building in town is said to be El Paso High School. Now, there have long been stories of strange happenings that take place at this school. And some of the stories have absolutely defied the laws of science, and those who experience these events swear they actually did happen. In fact, there is a picture that hangs in the one of the trophy cases in the lobby. Everybody in the picture is very sharp and distinct except one young lady. Her clothing is out of date. She's very faded. And there are those that who were in the picture who swore they had no idea who she was. Then in 1916, when they were building the building, this was the first building built to be a high school. There was a picture taken of the front. And there standing in front of it was a lady in a white dress. And the photographer swore at the time he took that picture, there was no one standing there. When I started research, I had retired and my wife didn't want me to sit around. So she's the one that pushed me to write more books. I'd already written one. And I thought it would be interesting to go to El Paso High. And I wandered into the principal's office. Security didn't seem to pay any attention to me. And he said, "What are you here for?" And I said, "I'm looking for ghosts." And he sent me to see a man named Toby Tovar. He was a math instructor, been teaching at El Paso High for over 20 years. And he took time from his scheduled to tell me some of the stories of the hauntings. He's an individual who had personal experience with the unknown while teaching at the school, but he's not a wild-eyed believer in ghosts and goblins. He's the skeptic's worst nightmare. A calm, dispassionate, analytical eyewitness to an impossible occurrence. Now, the way this building was designed, it was a central core, because in the days that this building was built, males and females didn't go to school together. That would be psychologically damaging to both. So one wing was a male wing and the other was a female. So you had duplicate either side. And one of the facilities was a gym that was kind of shaped like a missile silo. There was the basketball court, and then above it, there was a suspended track. And a number of years ago, he had been in the 80s. There was a snow day in El Paso, and of course that causes complete chaos and confusion here. And a number of teachers and students had arrived at school before classes were canceled. But the conditions were so bad, they couldn't be released to go home. Excuse me. So they decided to explore the school. And down in the basement, they discovered a hole in one of the passageways. And that led to a little corridor. And at the end of that corridor was a door. And that door opened into an abandoned classroom. And in that classroom were desks and student possessions. Looks like they just ran everybody out and sealed it up. Well, there were actually two classrooms hidden down there. And both of those classrooms, according to those who were in them later, had strange things that happened and strange sounds that couldn't be explained. In one particular classroom, there was a young lady's purse. And in that purse was a letter she had written to her boyfriend. And she had become a excuse me. I don't know what's got me sneezing. Well, apparently, based on that letter, she had a side of her personality nobody had seen in decades. But even in the letter, she made mention of some strange occurrences. Well, since I can't seem to stop sneezing and we've almost run out of time, we're going to call it a day. And in my next show, we'll talk more about the ghost of El Paso. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.